We are on Daf Hey Vav, and we're up to the two dots, which are one-fourth of the way down, actually, a line above one-fourth of the way down, Gufa. So yesterday what we had learned was Omar Shmur. Ha-mocher shtarchov l'chavero v'chazar mechalo, machul, l'afilu yoresh mocher. So we had a rather frightening halacha. Somebody goes out and sells a bond, which is to be used to collect the debt. He makes good money on his bond, maybe he sells it for 30 cents to a dollar, and now he turns around, and he says to the borrower that he is mochel the debt, he doesn't have to pay. Since the bond was only an instrument of collection, if there's no debt, there's nothing much to collect, is there? Therefore, says Shmuel, whoever really owns the loan, which is either the original lender or his heir, they can simply be mochel the loan. Now, you understand that this leaves open room for an awful lot of hanky-panky. Because somebody sells a bond, makes 30 cents to the dollar, and then he goes ahead to the guy that has the loan, and he said, listen, I'm ready to make you a deal that you can't refuse. I am going to be meichel that loan in return for 40% under the table. So now he makes already quite a good deal. He's got like this. He could have been up the creek without a paddle. The guy wasn't really able to pay. He was giving it to a collection agency. For that matter, he can collect 80%, and 30% from the other guy make money on his loan if the conditions are right. So we're really opening up the door to what's called kinunya. It is where they'll get together, the original lender and the original borrower. Amar Rabbi Yehuda, Bereid Rabbi Yehoshua, in such a case, in Pikeachu, if the buyer of the bond has any brains, first thing that he does when he buys that bond is he goes over to the borrower before the two of them get together, the lender and the borrower. He goes over to the borrower and he says, you know, I own this loan now, but I don't like the idea of pay to the bearer, and he assigned it and he signed the back of the check. How about if I pay you to go ahead and arrange a new contract that's just made out to me directly? You take care of it, I'll give you $100. You know, so he writes out a new contract. Now that becomes a new loan. And then he'll be able to collect no matter what. Of course, it's not really foolproof, because when he writes out a new contract, it's not going to be chal on previous sold nechassim. But at least he covers himself for that much. Otherwise, he's not undoing the old contract. So he can, if the other guy is meichel it, okay, so he'll lose the shibud on nechassim that had been sold previously. But this way he's at least covered. Because of leishtar b'shemayin, he'll write out a new check in his name directly, instead of signing on the back of the old check.
What's the literal meaning of the
Wave the dollar bills in front of the guy's eyes. Get him interested. That's all. It's a way of saying, you know, lead him on, seduce him with the cash.
Jingle the coin.
It's a big machlokes about the kama. What the halacha is about causing damage to somebody else. And it's one of the most complicated sugyas in Shas. Different levels of causation. So there's a level of causation that is called garmi, as opposed to just general groma, where the causation is viewed as direct. Those direct causes of people being damaged through what you do, there's a machlokas whether you're chayav. Says Amema, if you hold that we are doing dinah d'garmi, which would mean that we can collect for direct causes of damage, then this guy who was mochel the loan has caused this guy 100% loss on his money. Let's say he paid 30 cents to the dollar. He owes him every penny of those 30 cents to as many dollars as there were in the loan. Because now the guy just threw his money out. Therefore, despite the fact that Shmuel said he can be mochel and it's mochel, but he's still a mazik, and this guy can now sue him for the hezek that he caused him, and magibay the meishtor me'aliyah. He can collect from him everything, not only the 30%, because he was in possession of a chol, of the shtar. And this shtar could have gotten him the entire loan back. And he went ahead and cost him the entire value of that shtar, not only the money that he had collected from him. So he can't say, look, I'm really sorry, I'll give you back your money. Meanwhile, collecting under the table more money from the other guy, it's not going to help him. Because we all did it, the garmi is going to pay for the actual face value on the shtar. So therefore, you better watch out. The person, however, who holds that you can't collect in court even for directly caused damages. They have to be direct damages, not cause damages. So over there, all you can do is collect a piece of paper. Magnifate main the Arab Alman. Actually, you can't collect anything because the guy has the piece of paper, which is the... That ain't worth the paper it's written on, as we say. But in this case, apparently this word, that you could collect only the value of the paper, is brought as a reference to another case where you burnt a guy's shtarchov. So over there, if you don't hold a dinah d'garmi, the guy could say, what are you suing me for? For burning a piece of paper? Because everything else is caused. I mean, I caused you not to have an instrument that... I don't have to pay you for that. How much is that paper worth? Man, that ain't worth the paper it's written on. It's already been written. So then he would only pay for the value of the paper. In this case, of course, the other person has the paper. Now, what happened is, having looked, there was a mice like this that was brought to the Bezdin of Ravashi, where someone had been meichel alone. Raphram heard about the case, and Raphram was an observer, but he went over And he started arguing in front of the court. So many riots he brought that there is, in fact, an ability to collect into the Garmi, that Rav Ashi finally gave in and said, okay, I surrender. I have no way of answering all of this. He was made it. They have to be done in the Garmi. And let me tell you something. He went ahead and collected every last penny. Adli Beki Kishura Letzalmi. Kishura Letzalmi is a very interesting expression. A kishura usually is used. It means a large piece of wood. Usually you use it for building purposes. Building purposes, it doesn't have to be 100% straight and so on and so forth. It's going to be buried under the ceiling anyway. But if you're using it, let's tell me, suppose you are a painter or you're a designer. And you're picking out a piece of wood. It's got to be perfect. It's got to be perfectly smooth. It's got to be perfectly straight. So that's the type. It's an expression that means to perfection. Every last detail. That's a kishura letzalmi. Omer Amemer b'shvei de Rav Chama. How about, we've been discussing cases of the collection of a ketuvah and a balchov and what the din is. We discussed earlier mishum china. How about if a guy has two different payments that he has to pay up? He has a ketuvah tisha that's due against him, and he has a loan, a balchov. He has property, and he has money. He has to use the cash to be mesalik a balchov. So the balchov mesalik a bezuzi. You don't give a debtor. You don't give him a piece of property and say to him, you get your money out of the property. You have cash, you pay him in cash. But for the Isha, you can give her the property, Misakin Ale Bayar, and I'll tell you why. Aiki Dine, Vaiki Dine. The Balchov basically gave you cash. And since he gave you cash, I mean, he is basically relying on the fact that he can get cash back if you've got it. Masha Enken, she didn't give anything. She simply is due a ksuva. Now, it isn't really true that she didn't give anything because her Nechseg Son Barza, which are included in the ksuva, she did give. But the point is that was just added to the value of the ksuva. So we look at ksuva as being one entity. And since the ksuva is something that she is relying on a lien and karkaot to collect, so give her the karkaot. That, after all, was what she had in mind in the first place. When a guy makes a loan to you, he does not expect to be told, well, I'm sorry, I don't have any cash. You can go to court and try to sell the property. That's not the... And the truth is that we have a problem, as we'll see in a moment, that we have to worry about with the balchov that we don't have to worry about with an isha. And that is indicated in the next case. Suppose he doesn't have enough money to pay back, both of them. V'ilo ika lachad ara. Now, obviously, we're talking about over here that both the contract and the ketuvah had the same date. So since they had the same date, there was no earlier lien. So otherwise, we always go according to the lien, obviously. And that one is the one that the other person can't collect against because it was already a lien to the first person. But assuming that we have two contracts, one a ketuvah and one a balchov, dated the same day, there's only enough money to pay one. Which one do we pay? Says the Gemara, we pay the balchov. We always have a problem of a balchov, and you'll notice that we made many, many takanot that are based on keeping open the capital markets. It's very important for us not to dry out capital. Therefore, we put into effect a lot of laws that protect lenders, because that's all we need is for lenders to dry up, and then business dries up, and then we're really up to creep without a paddle. So, in order, shalotin ol delet b'fnei lovin, this is such an amazing contemporary issue, in order that we should not have doors slammed in the face of potential borrowers, and we want to have lots of investors happy with their ability to collect their money, we say, give him precedence over an isha with her ketuvah. And so you'll say, so then women aren't going to lose the chayin? Didn't we have that issue of chinah before? Yes, but remember that we always balance chinah with another issue. And that is that yoter, my time up, yoter mi masha ish rotzeh lisa, isha rotzeh lehinaseh. We have a rule that it's less likely that we're going to dry out marriage than we're going to dry out money lenders. Right? So in other words, women ultimately are willing to take more chances and marry than a lender is on giving his money to somebody. The woman likes to be married, so nebuch, she'll take her chances. Look at all those marriages out there where these women went ahead and took men that they should never have taken. But, you know, you're blinded by the fact that you want to get married. So because of that, we don't have to concern ourselves as much with the Isha as we do with the possibility of drying out the Balchov. Now, Tosfos is very concerned about the fact that we just had, 2 days ago, a Gemara that seemed to say the opposite, right? We said before that with the Koshel Shebehem, Yinatena Koshel Shebehem, Rabbi Tarfin's dictum, and against Rabbi Akiva about Ein Merachamim B'din. So we said over there, if you hold the Koshel Shebehem between the Balchov and the Isha, is the Isha, it's because of Chinah. So how can you say in the same case, we only have enough to pay one, that over there all of a sudden ignore China and go to the Balchov because you're looking at the Lutfi Fame Ovin in the space of two pages? I mean, you're contradicting yourself from one extreme to the other. So basically, and there's a number of different approaches on this. The Rabbeinu Tam's approach is that issues over there where it's talking about that the guy died, are not going to be Noel Delek Bifnei Lovin. Because Lovin don't usually take actuarial tables into consideration. So before insurance came around, they wouldn't even insure a loan. Was it such a terrible thing? A perfectly healthy person, you're lending money to it, you're not thinking it's going to drop down in 30 days before he pays. It's not enough of a chance to worry about. So there, we're not concerned about Shalotino Delek. But the inability to collect when there's not enough money to go around, that's exactly what he's concerned about. So there we have to worry and give precedence to Shalotino above the rights of the Isha and our concerns from Tina. Continues the Gemara. A case over here. Amar Leh Papa Rav Chana. I heard that you said, and is this really true? Because it did not strike me as ringing true. Is it really true that you said, in the name of Rava, that somebody who owes money, the Islay Ara, he's got property, va'ata balchov v'katov amine, a balchov comes now and demands it, v'amar le zil shkol mi'ara, and you say to him, look, I don't have any cash, so collect from my property. Is it true that Rava said that amrina le zil zavin at v'ayte havle? That the Bezin is supposed to tell him, you go and sell the property, and you go and you pay the balchov? I never heard of such a halacha. So it certainly seems to violate the norms of collection, as far as I know. Did you say that? Because it certainly, whoever heard of such a thing, the Malva lent the money in the first place because he knew that he always has access to a lien on the property. Not because he knew that he was going to get cash. If we were promising him cash, he never would have lent it. He's saying, look, as long as I know that I can go to court and grab your property and now put now an order against your property, I'm feeling okay. So how all of a sudden did we get to a point where he's going to be able to tell him, but actually, I meant that you should sell your property and pay me. But that's not what he was thinking. No, so where did it come from?
Instead of foreclosing,
that he could somehow get the courts to enforce an order that this person should liquidate his holdings. I mean, there's never a halacha like that in any country. We don't go take the guy, put him into jail until he liquidates him. We used to do that. But, I mean, that's middle-age law. Put the guy in debtor's prison, until he takes care of the issue. We simply go and we enforce an order against his property, and now this guy takes over, does whatever he wants to sell it, gets the court to sell it at an auction, whatever. I mean, that's common property, foreclosures and so on. We don't expect that the owner is the guy that's going to sell it. We're going to sit around and we're going to hope that he does a good job, right? And yet, this is what I heard you say in the name of Rava. Did you really say that? By the way, Tosis points out over here that let us not oversimplify. There are indeed cases where you do have to sell. For instance, suppose you owe money not because a guy made you a loan, but because you hired somebody to do a job. So if you hired somebody, the understanding is that you're paying him cash, not that he's going to sue you and foreclose your property. Although there is a halacha, by the way, about the din of foreclosures on mechanic liens and so on and so forth, which is something that we'll get to in Bob Metzia. But Lamaisa, over there, it's your responsibility to actually give cash. So Tosis points out that there's three completely different levels over here. There's lenders. The lenders were ma'adif the cash over here, that's for sure, as we said, because he gave you cash, you expect cash back. We have damage. When you are a damager, over there the Torah said, you pay him property. So there you can, l'chatchila, you can give him actually property. But if there's a bal chov and you have cash, you can't tell him, go collect against my property. You must give him the cash. And the court will enforce an order to the bank to make sure that your cash is taken and given to the guy, if you have both. When it comes to a sakhir, you're going to have to actually sell your property yourself and get him the money. Because he wasn't working for you with the understanding that he was supposed to go to court and sell properties and become an auctioneer. He made the deal only on the basis of cash. So what we're talking about over here is lender, specifically that case. Omar Lay, low, pa. Of course I never said that. Okay, come on, you said something. I mean, people make this up. So, Emily Gufadu of the Hekahad, will you tell me what happened, or don't just tell me no. Well, what did you say? What happened was like this. A guy was being collected against, and he had lots of money, plenty of cash. And when the lender wanted to collect from him, he claimed that the cash wasn't his. It had been given to him by this powerful goy, and the court couldn't start up with the goy to find out what was going on, and that therefore he's very sorry, but he can't pay. Now, the truth is, we don't believe him. But Tosis learns that the case is like this. By the time it got to court, the cash was gone. So therefore, the court could not enforce an order against the cash. So they held that since that person had acted in an untoward fashion towards the lender, the court was going to treat him cruelly because he acted in a way that was unacceptable. And the court has a right to do things that are vicious to people that are vicious. The Beis Din is able to enforce social conduct in him. And therefore, the case was Tolemo Tabo Viko Chavimavit. He was claiming that it wasn't his cash, which is difficult to believe. So, Hu Asa Shaloka Hogan? Lefika Hasubo Shaloka Hogan. He acts improperly. The court went out of its way to make life tough for him. You didn't want to give the cash you had? Go get the cash. What do you mean? Me? What do I know about auctioning property? That's not our problem, buddy. That's your problem. So that was a special case, but of course, Chas v'Shalom, I never quoted Rava saying this is the normal halacha when you're supposed to pay back a loan. If you really didn't have money, you really didn't have money, so then the other person will get now a lien against your property. You don't have to be the one to do the selling. Only with Kamer of Papa. L'didachta amarta priyat bal chov mitzvah. There's a big machlokas. What exactly is the source of the halacha of collecting against heirs? When somebody inherits a property from you, midiraita, do they inherit a lien? Is a lien a deoraita idea, or is a lien an instrument that was created by the Rabbon? The nafkamina would be, and there's two approaches. One man the Omar holds, and this is what we're asking, is Rav Papa. He holds, actually, liens are not a deoraita. So the basis of an heir paying back a debt that his father had is because there's a mitzvah to pay back debts. So it's a chiyav of a mitzvah. But there's no actual lien on the property. Suppose the heir is a katan. So we can't enforce a mitzvah on a cotton. Can't be mechayev a cotton. The cotton says, what do I got to pay back money for? So what do you mean it's a mitzvah? I'm a cotton. I'm mechayev a mitzvah. So there's nothing we can do. He's right. We can't force a cotton to be mechayev a mitzvah. So according to Rav Papa, who holds that, that's actually within midiraita. Suppose the heir, who is a gadol, would say, you know what? I don't like doing mitzvahs. Lo nechali, the avid mitzvah. I don't want to do a mitzvah. So go, you know, go argue with him. My, what would be the din? Is there a means to collect? Or is it just that, as far as the Torah would be concerned, if we wouldn't make that kanot to create liens that are enforceable, there'd be nothing you could do. The Tosis is a little bothered by this. He says, because there was never really any question that Besdin forces a gadol to do a mitzvah. So why would this be any different than anything else? Mm-hmm. But actually, says Tosis, we could learn that the Gemara was asking, this you call a mitzvah? In other words, it was like an ironic question. So you say that the whole din is because priyat balchov mitzvah. What exactly would happen if he doesn't want to do the mitzvah? You know darn well, we beat him to death. You're calling that a mitzvah? The guy has no choice. Of course he's going to pay back the loan. So that it was asked with an understanding of the implications right up front. But the truth is, of course, that ultimately, this is what many Rishonim learn, that ultimately, if the Gemara is going to tell us, yes, we can enforce a chiyav of a mitzvah, that, by definition, is the equivalent of a lien. Because what do we have to enforce it against his body? Why can't we enforce it against his bank account? So the only mode to enforcement is to beat the guy until he finally agrees to pay up. We might as well cut off his bank instead of cutting off his nose. So that's actually my core, because I don't understand what the Gemara's solution to this is. Omar lay, so Rav Papa said, well, Tanina, look, man, it says beferish, that ba'me dvarim amurim b'mitzvat lo ta'aseh.
Can the court force somebody to give Truman license?
Sure.
You can take it away from the produce.
Well, Tumas and Meisters, you mean where he's not going to be eating it? No, you can't force it.
So right? that's
because that's a monetary chiyuv that has no toveah. That's a special thing. There's no one that brings it to the court's attention. So it's a moment she'in lo toveim
it's not.
Right, because there's no particular. If the one Kohen will come, he'll say, excuse me, I don't know you. I have a friend of Kohen. He'll say, he'll get it. Leave me alone. So what are they going to do? All the Kohanim in the world will all get together and make a class action suit against this person.
I'd like
to see you get 10 Kohanim together.
Not very likely.
Okay, but this is a different thing. So he said, look, I mean, the Mishnah says, where do we say that a person gets Malkut Arba'im? This is Davka b'mitzvat lo ta'aseh. Guy did already in Aveira. So let's say he ate Tarfus. Okay, so we give him his Malkut Arba'im. But when it comes to a mitzvat aseh, let's say we tell the guy, okay, man, where's your sukkah? Or where's your lulav? And he says, I don't go for sukkahs and lulav, you know? So there, ve'ino oseh, and he refuses to make a sukkah, refuses to make a lulav, makino torche tetzin of show. You keep beating him until he drops dead. I mean, there's no, because we're not punishing you, we're trying to get you to move. So Mamela, in that case, I mean, certainly over here, that's the best mode of collection. Remember the remarkable story about good old Judge McDonn that I told you about. Right? Mm-hmm. The only judge in Maryland. This is a story of Abramowitz. His father was a lawyer. So the maisa was that this judge would actually, in Maryland, until very recently, a judge had the right to use a cat of nine tails at his discretion. And whipped the guy. And it was a whole maisa where he forced a man to give a get to a Jewish woman because the lawyer, it wasn't a kosher dinner, but the maisa insisted that the guy sign. The guy didn't want to sign, so he called the bailiff and said, bring out the whip. We'll whip him until he signs. So they made a tremendous stink about this and put it in the Sun papers. And it was like, you know, what kind of business? Where are we? The Middle Ages, and so on and so forth. See, he wrote in response, unbelievably, says, in Maryland, the law is that any recidivist is brought before the original judge who judged the first case. So every time he does the same misa, if he did it again, it's brought to the judge that knows that this is the same. He saw the whole story. So he knew what Einish didn't help, right? He says, you have to analyze now the statistics on wife beating in Maryland. Every case of wife beating in every judge in this state is brought countless times. Because the guy keeps, all right, it's worth it. I'll beat her again and I'll pay my fine, you know. It's worth it. He can't control himself. There's only one judge in this case, in this state, that never once had a case of recidivist wife beating. Me. Because you know why? Because when they come in here, I beat them. That's it. They never come back. That's the Terence Malchus, you know, what you're complaining about is old-fashioned, put him in jail and wreck his life. That's a better English. That'll work. Yeah, exactly. Now, the reason that we're bringing this up over here is because it has direct reference back to the machlokas that we had about Tfisa. We're going to use Tfisa. And remember, we had a machlokas about Tfisa, whether it's Basimta, no, Tfisa Basimta or Tfisa Bershutarab, excuse me, Bershut Rabin, machlokas Rav Shmuel on the one hand, Rabbi Yochanan Meir Shlakish on the other hand. So, because of that machlokas, we're bringing in this question. Somebody gives a get, and he says that the get should only be chal la'achar shloshim yom. And what happens is the woman takes the get, and she leaves it b'tzidei reshut harabim, not in her own house, but rather she leaves it right next to the street. So there, the question is, a get only works if at the time of the chalos of the get is in her reshus. If she would have left it in reshus harabim proper, it's clearly not in her reshus. The question is, what is the status of Rishus Etzidei Rishus Haravim, which is the area near the wall of the Rishus Haravim, where generally people don't walk right up against the wall because they don't want to get their clothes ruined by the wall. So it's protected from the Ravim to some extent. The truth is that there are other Etzidei Rishus Haravim, and Rashi is very medayik to be mechalik between them because of significant issues in the sugya, which we'll talk about. But here Rashi explains the union of Etzidei Rishus Haravim is particularly the area of the kotel. Remember that the other aspect of Tzidei Rishus Harabim is between the poles, remember? So over there, the truth is that we spoke about, and Tosis is very bothered by this, that if we said Beferish before, that you can be Kena B'Tzidei Rishus Harabim. If you be Kena B'Tzidei Rishus Harabim, it means that it's not called the Rishus Harabim. But if you take a look over there, Rashi is Beferish over there, Tzidei Rishus Harabim, differently than he's Beferish over here. So in other words, there, it's a mokum that is miyuchet to protect people that they can be at the edge and that nobody, no cars can go there. Over here, we're talking about cars don't go there because they want to avoid damage. But it's not that there's an area that is clearly set aside for something else. So that's a question. That must be the way Rashi is understanding the difference between the sugyas. Tosis leaves it hanging. So I don't understand. Why the Gavi Akinya did we say earlier that, yeah, it's not a problem. And here we're worried about whether it would have remained in her rishus after she already got the get. Does it remain in her rishus if she puts it between her rishus or rabbit? Doesn't have an answer. Okay, so in any event, what's the halacha? Omar Le, and here's where we have now reference to our sugya, and why this was brought here in the Gemara. He told him, no, not a good get. Because since the get is Betzidei Rishus Harabim, clearly it isn't in her Rishus. And I know that from Rav and Shmuel. Because when Rav and Shmuel were talking about, where did Rabbi Tarfon hold that Tfisa was okay, when the guy died and he left Perot Lushim in our Mishnah. And it said over there, whoever gets there first is the one that gets them. And we were only discussing the Motar, remember? So, we asked, and where were these perot munachim? So there was a machlokas. Rav and Shmuel said that the tfisa only helps in reshut harabim. And I would assume that tzidei reshut harabim are like reshut harabim. That Tosis says, what? What? He also used the word reshut harabim. I understand. How do you bring a bigger raya from Rav and Shmuel? No. Rami Bar Chama's own question indicated that he knew that. Then is it reshut harabim? So you're going to jump to a conclusion? So Tosis, it must be that he had in mind the fact that Rav and Shmuel contrasted the din of Rishus Harabim, aval, what do they say? Aval, besimta. Besimta lo. So therefore, what do you mean besimta? A simta is the other extreme. Because a simta is an area that's not seated Rishus Harabim next to where people go. It's basically an area off to the side, which is used as a cafe where people can sign deals and so on and so forth. So it's bedafka removed from the Rishus Harabim for purposes of kinyan. Which means that over there and only over there do we say that remains in the Rishus of the Yatomi. If Rav and Shmuel wanted to contrast Rishus HaRabin with Sinei Rishus HaRabin, it would be absurd for them to have gone to the case of Simta. It must be that that's the idea, that the contrast of Rishut HaRabim to a simta. And therefore, when they said Rishut HaRabim, they obviously, in context, included Tzidei Rishut HaRabim, says Tyson, with the Rishut HaRabim. There's your answer. So that means that just as you understand as the get would be in Rishut HaRabim, it wouldn't be in the Rishut of the woman. So Tzidei Rishut HaRabim is obviously the same thing. So he said... Right, but if you own... Correct, but once a person owns something, it's considered, in other words, I could do Mishicha, I can make something mine. If it's literally in Rishut HaRabim, I can't even make it mine, because there's no extensions of self. Remember that, generally speaking, we say there's an extension of territory, which is well recognized, by the way, psychologically. That's the problem people have going into elevators. There's personal space. So personal space extends for 4 amot. But none of that is true in Rishut HaRabim Gufa, where you're constantly being crossed by other people. So there's a violation of the whole concept of personal space. You can't maintain ownership claiming that it's personal space. But in areas that are left for people to be allowed their personal space, even though other people could also have personal space there, but I can't go push your stuff away to put my stuff down like I would in Rishut HaRabim. So over there, Enochinami, that's our question. Even though it's not her own chatzer, but since it's her property, she doesn't lose. It's not considered to be out of her control when it's in this kind of location. That's what we were thinking. So Rami Bar Chama said, well, you could say, Adarabim, you want to bring the Araya from Rav and Shmuel? I'll bring your Araya just the opposite. I will say that on the contrary, I'll prove to you from Rav Nachman's psak that she is Mugaresh, because the Omer of Nachman, Omer Rav Bar Avua, Ha'omer l'chaveiro, mishoch parazo, v'lo tiyek nuya l'cha ad li'ach l'shloshim yom, kana afilo omedet ba'agam. Remember this little maysa? So if a person makes now a kinyan, and that kinyan should be chal after 30 days, even if that para is now in the middle of a swamp, that mashicha helped because it could have been accomplished in that agam anyway. So mamela, we view it as one long act. It's talking about, he said, mi'akshav over there. So Tosu says, we're going to have to understand the sugi here. It's talking about mi'akshav also. Yes. So it's omedet ba'agam. So my love, I mean, is there essentially a difference between an agam and Tzidei Rishut HaRabim? I mean, isn't an agam essentially an area in which anybody could come, but people don't usually walk? The same thing, Tzidei Rishut HaRabim. People don't usually walk there because they don't want to get dirty. Okay, an agam, you don't walk there because you don't want to get messy and muddy. So what's the difference? Same thing, no? No, that's not right. Come on. I mean, agam l'chud. I mean, look, an agam is not near the Rishut HaRabim. It's not even pressured to walk there. I mean, what's the comparison? Agam is one, then perhaps Tzidei Rishut HaRabim is another. Then I don't see that as right. Ikidiyami. Others say that actually it was just the opposite. That what Rav Chisda had told Rami Bar Chama L'chatchila was, let me bring a riot to you that she is Megureshet from Rav Nachman. So he was the one who said Rav Nachman, Omale Megureshet, meaning Rav Nachman, and I assume that Tzidei Rishut HaRabim, essentially like an agam, to which he said, why? I don't know, but I can tell you, ain't a Megureshet because of Rav and Shmuel. Because again, I'm a dayak from Rav and Shmuel who said that Tfisa only helps in a Rishut HaRabim, where it wasn't in the Rishut of the Yatomim. And that seems to mean the same as Tzidei Rishut HaRabim, because otherwise why did they contrast it with Simta, as Tosfos explained earlier? And we thought that was the original response of Rav Chisda. So my love, Haini Rishut HaRabim, Haini Tzidei Rishut HaRabim, says, well, not necessarily. Not necessarily. Maybe basically the point that they were making was that a Simta, Tzidei Rishut HaRabim, anything that is not Rishut HaRabim, is the equivalent of a Simta. Maybe that's what they were saying. In which case they were saying Rishut HaRabim Lachud, Tzidei Rishut HaRabim Lachud in this version. So we have two different ways of understanding whether we can make that diyuk in Rav and Shmuel. That's what it boils down to. What the halacha would be for Rav and Shmuel.
Do we have an answer to our
board? No, we don't. Halacha l'maisa, however, this last piece stands. And Tzidei Rishut HaRabim does not have a din over here as remaining in the Rishus of the Isha.
But for Shabbos, these
yes, that's a completely different thing, because over there, there's really three different areas that we need to define the nature of Rishus. One is in terms of ownership, which is what we're talking about over here, where Rishus HaRabim is defined differently than it is in the other two areas. The other areas when it comes to Tumah B'Taira, Sofik Tumah B'Rishut HaRabim, Sofik Tumah B'Rishut HaYachid, where over there it's defined in terms of the number of people that are currently in that place. Mm-hmm. It has nothing to do with spatial definitions. Exactly. And yeah, even your house can be in the middle of your living room, it's Rishut HaRabim because there's three people there. And because we learn often Seita, so that's the point. And then there is, of course, Shabbos. For Shabbos, it's a spatial definition that has to do with boundaries, spatial boundaries. No connection between these three areas. So we use the word Rishut HaRabim, but it can mean totally different things in different contexts.
Context?
Yeah, you'd rather be in a different context. Let's say, yeah, say white all around, or blue all around, right?
I think he's still on that boat.
He'd rather be sailing, or he'd rather be skiing, or... What else are we talking about?
Sleeping?
Black. He'd rather be dead, basically.
No, not that far.
Not that far. Only half of Bishishi. Fine. You're on.
Zukta Heidekanishna.
Hamoshiv et ishto chenvanit. Oshimina apotropia. Now listen, the din is that normally you cannot, unless you have a clear-cut claim against the person, you cannot take them to court. You can't say, listen here, I have a suspicion that you've been cheating me. What is that supposed to mean, you have a suspicion? I'm supposed to worry about your suspicious mind? However, there are certain situations in which cheating is so prevalent, and we're talking about over here white-collar crime.
Like the Israeli tax authority.
Yeah. In other words, when you are working for someone else, and you are placed in a position of authority over his things, and you're constantly saying to yourself, you know, I work so hard for this guy, I do so much better than everybody else, why shouldn't I be allowed to take a paperclip home from the office? Big deal. So I'll take a couple boxes of paperclips. Now, let's say you just stole, let's say, $1.50. If the guy would have known you stole $1.50, he could take you to court. Since it's so prevalent that you're going to do a little cheating here and there, you're a chenvanit. You've been hired to be at the cash register. Somebody brings back a bottle of milk. You drink it for lunch. You don't put it up against your cash register. So the chazal were mitakein, and this is in order for these types of relationships to work. Because otherwise, why would a guy take somebody as any doubt? Exactly. So you need to be able to put in a claim against the person, mitzada safek. What good will it do you? You can force him to swear. So these kind of cases, partnership cases, chenvanit cases, where you make somebody a ne'eman on something, so he's your agent to take care of money and so on, you can put him in a position of you're suspicious, and he understands it's a chatzila, that he, when the deal is over, he's got to be willing to take a shvur that he didn't do anything wrong, he didn't take anything that wasn't his. How about if your wife you hire to be at the cash register? You have a store, and you hire your wife to get the cash register. Now, the truth is that theoretically speaking, again, we are very much influenced by romantic notions of marriage. But in the advanced vision of marriage of Chazal, which is much more advanced, which is getting the 21st century is getting close to the vision of Chazal, in which they're beginning to understand that just because you love somebody, it doesn't mean you give them all your money, and it doesn't mean that you have a right to take over your wife's bank account, and that suddenly you're suddenly sharing everything. There's no such thing. If she has money, and she says, "Eni nizon et veniosa," whatever, you have no say whatsoever. The opposite is also true. Where a woman marries you, it's all of a sudden she owns your money. So technically speaking, if she is serving a meal and she breaks some expensive china, she should have to pay. In other words, if a guy wants his wife, you're a careless no good nick. You got lots of money in your bank account, go ahead and buy me new china. What'd you break the china for? So there we make a takana, again for shalom bayis, that she's not chayeves in normal householdish. However, in an opposite case, certainly not a normal household relationship, that your wife should be running the store. Or you can make her an apotropia on the entire business. You got a whole business, you say, you know what, you're in charge of this corporation, I got no time. You can do that. But then she's in the same position of anybody else that would be an apotropos, or anybody else that would be in Chendani. She's in charge of the cash register, you have no way of knowing what she's doing. So you could be much be a her at any time. So therefore, Moshim et ishto chenvanit. Oshemina apotropia, harezu mashbia kozman sheyirtze. Rebbe Eliezer says, what do you mean if you make her a chenvanit? The woman is working in your house. She is baking challahs. How do you know she's not selling challahs on the side? And putting that money together for her big getaway to Hawaii. How do you know? You don't know. So she's always basically in charge of the store. So therefore you should be able to bake her, make a shvua. You didn't steal any challahs this week and sell them off. Or if she's making threads, she's working with her pellet, her spindle. So if she's working with her spindle, maybe she's selling off half of the stuff she's making.
Swindling.
Okay? So you can make her swear al pilchav alisata. Iboilu. When Rebbe Eliezer said you can make her swear, what did he mean? That you can actually sue your wife and say, I'm very suspicious of you that you're selling challah. I want you to take a shvuah that you're not selling challah. Or was just Rebbe Eliezer was referring back to the Tanna Kamma. The Tanna Kamma says, look, we have a special halacha about a chenvanit and apotropi. And that special halacha does not allow Gilgal Shvua. Because Gilgal Shvua, what is the halacha of a Gilgal Shvua? Gilgal Shvua means if already you're chayav on a Shvua. So Mamela, we say, you know what, you're going to take a Shvua anyway. We wouldn't have been chayav you a Shvua on this thing. But since you're taking a Shvua anyway, add in the words, or the chalas. So in other words, if now you're saying, look, I swear I didn't take anything that wasn't mine when I was in charge of the cash register, so the guy could say, according to Rebbe Eliezer, and also say, you didn't take any challahs, and so on. But it doesn't mean that we can actually make a woman swear that she didn't sell the challahs she was baking, right? So it's because the Tanakhama held, remember, Eliezer understood that when they were saying that she could take a shvua, since this is only a shvua drabbanan, it's not Rashi, it's not a shvua drabbanan, there's no gilgal, and that's what it revolves around. So they held there's no gilgal shvua. Comes along Rabbi Eliezer saying, no, you could even be megagal shvua. Or did Rabbi Eliezer go to town? Rabbi Eliezer held, forget about gilgal shvua. You can actually lechatchila, because ultimately, what is the difference, says Rabbi Eliezer, between the woman who has the keys to the store or the woman who has the keys to the pantry? It's the same thing. And therefore, every woman is really an apotropos on your home. So this is not a different issue. We're not talking about Gilgal. This is the same thing. Tashma. Amrula Rabbi Eliezer. In a brighter, the Chachonim said to Rabbi Eliezer, that is insane. Make a woman swear that she doesn't sell the chalas. I mean, then she has a right to sue for divorce. In Adam Dar, in Nachash Bikfifa. You can't live with a snake. I mean, this husband is a snake. Everything that she does. Oh, I'm suspicious. I'm suspicious. You're going to live with a guy like that? That's abuse. So, if you're going to tell me that Rabbi Eliezer held that you can actually make her swear that she didn't take chalas. Okay, I understand, chakra, that you could say that's insane. When a woman says, but I'm a chuyav to take a shvua, that's horrific. But if all Rabbi Eliezer meant was, look, we've already understood that originally when you took the job of taking care of the cash register, that you would be like anybody else who takes the job. It's nothing personal. So you would be taking a shvua. So now you're going to take the shvua, right? So what do you care if you add in the words and the chalas? So it shouldn't make a difference. Why is that? Why is that a nachash? It doesn't really matter, does it? He says, well, what do you mean it doesn't matter? The woman says to her husband, it has nothing to do with the question of whether I need to take the shvua. That's not the point. The point is that you're a total idiot. I can't live with a guy like you. A man who has that kind of thoughts about his wife, to make his wife swear, even though I'm swearing because I'm a chanvanita, I understand anybody would swear. But come on, baby, this is a joke. People are going to hear I'm swearing about not selling cows. This is, you're nuts. And that's the point, that he can't die with a nachash, not because of the fact that he's going to be able to force her to take a shvua. It's the whole attitude that she says, you obviously do not love me. That's what she says. You clearly don't love me. Right? I mean, if you love me, you would have a certain level of relationship. I can't live with a guy that clearly is only suspicious, thinks about his stupid nickels and dimes, and his darling wife to her, to him, is nothing but a hired hand. I refuse to live like this. Toshma. In a case where a person did not do, which the next Mishnah discusses, did not write out a shtar in which he potters her from any need to ever take a neder or a shvua. I mean, how can you take a neder? What is that supposed to mean? You can take a neder by being mechayev her to say, asur all fruit on yourself forever if you stole money. So that's basically making a shvua, but it's making a shvua in the form of a neder. Yeah, this doesn't work.
No,
where's that?
Yes. A taser.
I got like a sort of weak one, only 200,000 volts.
Oh, you got one?
I got one. No, I got a real taser.
Really?
Same, but well, I have my kids always walk around with tasers.
Because
I've been attacking kids. Right? I walk down the shower.
I wouldn't mind using one. I don't need one.
So anyway, so I'll bring it in tomorrow.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, combine taser and electroshock therapy, you know?
Maybe it could actually work.
Right.
We can put one on either side, you know, have good old nurse...
Ratchet.
Good. So the question that we have over here is, it says in the writing, somebody who did not write out such a p'tur, did not give his wife a p'tur from Nedim and Ashur, and or Shivak and Bani, or Shemina Apotropia, but if he didn't, you can't make a wife swear on normal household things. Was Rabbi Eliezer Omer, or lomina apotropia, you can still be mashbiyah kozman shiyirtzeh. Why? Because by definition, a woman is an apotropos on her home. She ain't lecha isha. She lo naset apotropia sha'achat b'chayei ba'ala al pil chavalas isata. You gave her the keys to the pantry. She's taking out the flour from the pantry. She's removing the raw wool. So then she's an apotropia. Amrulo ein adam darim nachash pekvifa. Okay, but now it's very clear what the machlokas is. We aren't talking about gilgal. We're talking about lechatchila. That's exactly what they said. They said, but if it wasn't chenvanit, you can't make her swear. And Rabbi Eliezer says, oh no, even if she wasn't a chenvanit, you can make her swear specifically on this, because every woman is an apotropia. Shmamina lechatchila shmamina.
In most instances, when we say ein adam darim nachash pekvifa, are we not referring to the woman?
In most instances, yes, but certainly not. No, not in every instance,
yeah.
Because we were talking. He wants to know whether it lasted.
Somehow that doesn't look like a firm bond of trust. A good way to start a marriage is keep asking your wife to swear that she isn't.
Well, yeah, that's what they tell her. That's exactly what they tell her. But Yerushalmi, Tosfos actually brings the Yerushalmi that compares the case and says, look, if this is what Rebbe Eliezer held, then you should be able to force her to pay you for broken china too. And it's the same relationship. Mm-hmm. You're saying the norms of a relationship do not apply, and it's a technical relationship of damagee and damager, and so on and so forth. That's crazy. Then the lesson of Yerushalmi is, you'll never have shalom bayis v'yelam. How can you have a house like that? So therefore, we can't allow that type of relationship. But even though, technically speaking, you may be right, ultimately, looking at the legalities of it, she is an apotropia. And there is a takana that an apotropia swears. But there's no way that Chazal would have made a takana that could have applied in marriage. It would have simply destroyed marriages. Right? Yerushalmi says it very, very cynically. So what is she? Is Shemar Chinam or Shemar Tzachar? I mean, like, what is the Chinam over here exactly?
Before he got married, the night he came with his wife, we will never quarrel about
money.
No, about property losses. And he came with her before the wedding.
That's the next Mishnah. Oh. We're about to introduce that.
Zukta Heidegger Mishnah.
Katavala, suppose a man makes a scheme with his wife. I will never fight with you over money. And I'm not going to make you chas v'shalom, swear to me, but I'm never going to have that kind of business relationship. Neder v'shvua, ein li alayich. I can't come along and say, I've lost my faith.
Swear.
You said that you're not going to? Okay, what shvuah this is, the Gemara is going to ask. Which shvuah are we talking about? I mean, why would they be thinking about
shvuah? What, hope to die?
Aval, but, mashbiyahu et yorsheha. So now, let's say he divorces her. And now he wants, now there's yorshim. The Yorshim, now, he wants them to swear that she didn't tell us at the time that she was dying that she had certain, maybe it was Paruah. He's saying it was Paruah. I gave her a wallet and I told her to keep the wallet. Swear that she never told you that. That's the shvuah of a Yorish. Obviously, the Yorish can't swear that he knows, but he can swear that, look, my mother never said before she died that we're not allowed to collect the ksuvah because you already gave her money. She never said that. So we don't believe you. So that he can make them swear. That's called shvuat Yorshim. For that matter, if there is a ba mikocha, somebody is coming now to collect the ktuvah because they bought it from her, he can also make them swear, the same shvua. Swear that she didn't tell you that this was already paid up. That's the same as shvuat yorshi. So he's able to be mashbiyad yorsheha, or to be mashbiyah, somebody who had bought her ktuvah, and I was coming with her koach. So she's ba'im reshuta. Suppose, however, he would have said, neder v'shvua ein li alayich v'al yorshayich v'al ba'im reshutech. Suppose then he left his rights behind. Which this continues the question of men that have given up their rights in marriages, right? I talked earlier. So this is a continuation to the area of Neder v'Shvua. So then he cannot make her swear, lo hiva, lo yorsheav, lo atabayim berushuta. But his yorshin can be mashbiyota. His yorshin can say, look, before we're going to pay you the ktubah, we want you to swear that you never got money. Or those that are ba'im mikocha, they could say, swear that she didn't tell you that there was money. So the Yorshav can be mashbiyan otav et Yorshav et ba'im b'rishuta. If the guy said, neder v'shvua ein li v'lo li Yorshav v'lo li ba'im b'rishuti, alayich v'al Yorshayich v'al ba'im b'rishuteich. But if he says, I and anyone who has taken over my rights, whether he be heir or purchaser, will never be able to make you or your heir or purchaser swear. You see, this is the same format that we had in the earlier Mishnah about ein li on the chasayich and not the perot, and not the perot. It's the same idea. So then, eno yachol lahashpiyah lohu, v'lo yorshah, v'lo abayim reshuto, and lo otah, v'lo yorshah, v'lo abayim reshuta. But, depends what the case is. Because consider, if she goes directly from his funeral to her own home, or for that matter, she goes to her parents, or his parents' home. So she goes back from the kever, or chami kever ba'ala l'beit aviyah, or she chazra l'beit chamiyah, v'lo naset apotropia. And she never had anything to do with the estate. So then, exactly, then ina yoshi mashbinota. But suppose the kids were young, she goes back home, and until they work things out for 2 weeks, she's at home, and then they work out what to do with the estate, and how to take care of her, and so on, and ultimately she moves into her in-laws. But for those 2 weeks, she had the keys to the store. And that has nothing to do with him. At this point, she is now acting as the apotropis for the yorshim. They can make her swear. He can't potter her from a shvuah that she owes somebody else. That's a whole different deal. It's not that they inherited the rights to the shvuah. It was a direct relationship between herself and the people for whom she was the apotropis on the estate. Now, this happens very often. It's actually rather rare that an almana should go from her husband's funeral and go back home to her parents and never have anything to do with the money that was in the house. So therefore, it's all very nice to talk about the heirs can't make her swear, but in practical terms, it ain't ever going to happen because she's always going to be in a position of being an apotropos, even for that short period. So imna set apotropia, even for that hour, hayoshim mashbi'inota, once they're mashbi'a her, then they can be mashbi'a her, but only alatid lavot. They can only be mashbi'a from what happened after the funeral. But they cannot be mashbi'a her, since she has a specific tour from the husband, that my heirs will never be mashbi'a you. You can't be mashbi'a. You can't say, but can we be magalga l'shvua? No, can we be magalga l'shvua? In mashbi'inota, amasha'apar.